I think that's the part that's most disconcerting to me, is that there we can't reach even our own family and friends with some simple logic, some simple basic facts, because they can't receive it. They're captured by a narrative that prevents them from thinking for themselves.
Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here. Welcome to our discussion for the day. And today I am speaking with Ted Kuntz. And Ted is the president of Vaccine Choice Canada. Ted, thanks so much for coming on and having an open and honest dialogue with me this afternoon.
Well, Michael, thanks for inviting me. And thank you for all your good work. You've been instrumental in bringing forward issues that our mainstream media and our governments don't seem to want to talk about. So you're very much appreciated.
Well, I honestly, it's been such a joy listening to intelligent people who are very often compassionate people, who are very often cautious people, saying, wait a minute, let's just stop and think. That's actually been a pleasure that I've been able to enjoy for the last year and a half while we've been doing this. Okay, but Ted, I want to give credit where credit's due, and I want to go all the way back to the monumental tin foil hat conspiracy theory world. And I remember, and you might have to correct me on the dates, but I remember very early on in the pandemic, I had all of these great concerns. The moment medical choices were being decided for us, the moment I'm being told I have to shut my church while I can walk down the street to Walmart. Not that if they shut Walmart, I'd be any happier.
Right.
The moment all of these arbitrary mandates started coming out, I started digging and started doing research, and I came across this public document, and the public document was the lawsuit that Rocco Galati submitted on behalf of Vaccine Choice Canada. I think there's 13 plaintiffs that are a part of that that lawsuit, and only Vaccine Choice Canada, I think, remained one of the not blacked out plaintiffs, where you took credit for doing right. your work. And protected some of the other individuals. That was a great service. But, you know, I think it's 199 pages of information. And I just started reading the history of the vaccine industry and the connection that was seemed to be very well documented in the submission, that there was conflicting interests going on everywhere, with Fauci, the NIH gain of function research, big pharma, all of these things. And of course, it was Vaccine Choice Canada that's been watching what's going on. So Ted, can you help our listeners understand kind of the role that Vaccine Choice Canada plays? How much research do you guys do? What's the quality of your research? Like, where, you know, how do you do all that? Where does Vaccine Choice Canada come into the picture? You've been a great help so far. Give us some information.
Well, maybe I should give a little bit of background. First of all, Vaccine Choice Canada is not a new organization like so many that have arrived in the last 2 years, thankfully. But we've been around for 40 years. This is actually our 40th anniversary. And so we've been in this area of examining the claims of the vaccine industry, the government policies around their efforts to mandate their products, the vaccine products, particularly for our children, and taking away the right of parents to make medical decisions for their children. So we've been in this battle for 40 years. And our relationship with Rocco actually predated COVID. We retained Rocco in 2019, before COVID was even on the scene, because we felt like the Ontario government had become far too egregious in its violation of the fundamental rights of bodily sovereignty, of informed consent, and of the right of parents to make medical decisions for their children. They had introduced policy that would require that if a parent in Ontario did not follow the recommended, and I use that word intentionally, because it is only a recommended schedule. If they did not follow it completely 100%, if they refrain from even one of the recommended shots, that they were then compelled to attend a, what we call a forced education session, where they had to, you know, taking a line out of the movie Cool Hand Luke, they had to get their minds right. And in addition to the education session, they were forced to to sign a document, which Rockwell calls compelled speech, which says that they are knowingly putting their child's life at risk. And we just felt like that level of coercion had crossed already what we thought was far too much coercion by the Ontario government. And so we retained Rockwood that time to take the Ontario government to task on their coercive measures. When COVID showed up in January of 2020, we could already see, as you did, that we saw the level of coercion. We saw the narrative that suggested that there's no way out of this except an injection. Having policy that was not grounded in science or data was based upon a political agenda rather than evidence-based. And so for those of us that have been in this vaccine risk awareness movement for decades, it was clear to us that what we were seeing was not good science, was not good medicine, was violating fundamental individual rights and freedoms. And so we went back to Rockwell and said, would you help us with this? We think we have to take on the Canadian government, we have to take on the CBC, we have to take on the government of Ontario, public health officers. I mean, I can't remember how many plaintiffs or how many defendants are in our case. And of course, Rocco was willing to work with us again. But the question he asked us, Michael, was how big do you want to play? Do you want to stay small and just simply focus on the actions of the Ford government or Trudeau? Or are we going to talk about the global conspiracy? And it is a conspiracy and it's not a theory. And Rocco was very clear about that. And our board of directors had a number of conversations with Rocco where we said, if we're going to do this, we're going to talk about the big agenda. We're not going to shy away from it. We're not afraid of being labeled conspiracy theorists. And so we went for it. And as you said, the statement of claim is 196 pages or something. And, we've been accused and criticized, as has Rocco, that, we were... violating all of the rules of proper legal process by having a statement of claim that's far too long and that it's going to be easily dismissed. And we did that intentionally. Rockwood did that intentionally. He knew that this information had to become part of a public document. It had to be in the system. We needed to alert Canadians to what was actually happening. And we were accused of being conspiracy theorists and, making all kinds of things up. But it's amazing how many of those things that we said have eventually been affirmed as being true. And I had a conversation with Rocco last week when I said, is there anything that we said in that July 6th statement that is not true, has not been verified? And he said, everything we said has turned out to be true.
And the information was pretty easy to get to even way back then.
Yeah.
Because I'm no lawyer, so I don't, if you sat 10 lawyers in a room and said, is this statement of claim really well written? They might have differing opinions. But as I read it, it's like, okay, here's my thing. Here's my source. Okay, I'm going to go look at that. Or here's the accusation. Okay, let me go check three or four other sites. And it's all very easy to track. In fact, I wanted to make a few points for our listeners really clearly. The Daily Wire in the US was reporting on some of the same things that you were reporting on weeks before Rocco submitted that claim statement.
Right.
You had US sources from their foreign aid department making some of those exact same claims. And then what you did with it in making it public was such an important move, mm-hmm. because it it became a bedrock for so many people to do research. I literally sat down with my health unit at one point with all of the different articles that we could follow up from that paper and then from other papers. And, you know, we'd be talking, you know, science, and be like, well, wait, have you looked at this? And the local health unit hadn't looked at anything.
Right.
So it was really important. And I do want to do a shameless shout out right now, because we did the same thing recently. James Kitchen is working in Alberta with a chiropractor in Alberta. And that's our Curtis Wall case. And James had 4 or 5 expert witnesses come, and James has released all of the expert witness testimony that we presented, and he's released the expert witness that the government of Alberta presented. That's on our website, libertycoalitioncanada.com. It's over 1,000 pages long, and if you want to talk about a transcript that is similar in its power to what you guys released, everybody should really have that as a resource, because you're going to see in those transcripts just how awful the Alberta key witness was in comparison to the key experts that we brought in. So, yeah, I just want to do that. Thank you for doing that early on. So, Ted, here's the question you've been dealing with for 40 years. I also want to give you the opportunity. Like, have you had the opportunity just to say, hey, for those of you who are new to the game, we told you so. Like, have you guys just had that opportunity to, I'm giving you that opportunity right now if you want it.
Well, you know, I thought that phrase? Yeah, many times. I think, you know, I recognize how difficult it is to see how dark this is. You know, I mean, I'm a parent that vaccinated my child and he was harmed. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I participated in the harming of my son. That I wasn't a responsible parent. I didn't do my homework. I didn't exercise my right to informed consent. I simply accepted a medical treatment on faith with no homework. And so I know how difficult it is for people who have participated in, you know, this vaccination paradigm and participated in following all of the rules so that, you know, there were good Canadians, to begin to see that they had been deceived. And so, we have been massively deceived and massively manipulated. And that's a hard thing, I think, for humanity to admit to. It takes some humility to say, you know what, I was deceived. I didn't do my homework. I didn't exercise critical thinking. I didn't dare to ask the questions that I should have asked.
So let me ask you two of the questions that I know you've been asked a lot, probably, but they are the two questions that keep coming up. So first of all, is Vaccine Choice Canada against all forms of vaccination? Like, is the I am asking this just from the bottom of my heart, in the sense of, you know, we have 4 children. We went to Africa. We did some extra vaccinations for Africa. My wife did not want to do it. We've struggled with the fact that we did it. But then you sit down with any one of my general practitioners, any MDs, and you just say, I have questions about the vaccine. And you are so, like, the level of disdain that you are treated with. Right. Like, I'm thinking of 2 specific doctors who belittled every fraction of research that my wife did. And also just go back to the, look, we've defeated polio. We've defeated this. We've defeated that. You must do this. If you're the 5 kids in the classroom, you're putting the other 5 at risk. The intensity in which vaccination cannot be questioned. So I'm just going to ask you it. Like, do you think there's any validity in historic vaccination? Has there been a turn that would make it less ethical now in what they're doing? Do you say, hey, we totally support vaccination. We just want people's medical, you know, consent and their privacy and their parental choice to be protected. Like, really, where is the concern level here?
So, Michael, that's a great question. So first of all, let me speak to the part about what position we take on vaccinations. And our title of our organization says it, Vaccine Choice Canada. We want to protect and preserve the right of Canadians and all citizens to inform consent and to medical choice. And what we're seeing now is they're taking away that right to medical choice. We're being coerced, terrorized into participating. And it's, you know, with COVID, it's not even a vaccine, as those of us that have done our homework recognize. It doesn't prevent infection or transmission. It's actually a treatment and not a very good treatment at that. But no, we support
agree with you on that. I've interviewed enough medical researchers and doctors, like on the fact alone that the mRNA injection has our cells present the spike protein on our own cells. That in and of itself, I'd say that's problematic. I don't want my body attacking my own cells. Right. I'm out.
Right.
So absolutely, I agree with you. Go ahead.
And so to me, that's just part of the deception. But our position is we want people to be well enough informed and understand the risks and the benefits and be able to make their own decision. And you know, if you choose to take one or all of them, to me, I just want to make sure that you're in a position to be able to make that decision. But what you've described as our experience is that when you start to ask questions, you are shamed and belittled and silenced and marginalized, as opposed to showing up with good, solid evidence that would help me to make an informed decision. You know, when I began to do my research after my son was vaccine injured, first of all, I got stonewalled. I mean, they were not willing to acknowledge vaccine injury. And it was me who went and did the research. I was a graduate student at the University of British Columbia. I went into the medical library and I pulled out all of the scientific research I could find on the shot that harmed my son. And there was compelling evidence, and they eventually withdrew that product off of the market because of how much neurological injury that it caused. They still never admit publicly that that product was not safe. And so, you know, my issue with them is they're not telling the truth. There's a political agenda around vaccinations as opposed to treating this like every other medical product. The other concern I have with vaccinations is that we don't hold the manufacturers liable or accountable for the injury and death caused by these products. And to me, that's incredibly dangerous. You know, vaccinations are the only product on the market, and I'm not just talking about medical products, any product on the market, a manufacturer is liable for injury and death caused by their product, except vaccines. And that should scare the hell out of all of us. So it's the lack of accountability that I find disconcerting, and it's the lack of honesty. You know, a parent, you know, when you go purchase another pharmaceutical product. Somebody gave me the insert for a sleep aid this week, and it's a sheet of paper that's about 6 by 8 feet with small print on it. I know that the product information insert for the COVID injections, I don't know if you've seen them, Michael. Have you seen what it is? It's a blank piece of paper with 5 words on it that says, "This space has been left intentionally blank," or something to that effect. You know, it's such a violation of the most fundamental principles of ethical medicine that we're not given information to be able to make a choice. So our organization is about protecting that right to choice. Now, my own personal situation is the more that I looked into this medical practice, the more questions that I have about safety, efficacy, and necessity. There's a narrative out there that we solved the world's, you know, smallpox and polio with these injections. If you go back and look at the research, it's hard to substantiate those claims with evidence. It's a very powerful narrative, and we love having a magic solution to, you know, our problems. To me, it simplifies a very complex health condition. You know, we think that if we simply take an injection, we're all good. And we're fine. And I think that does a disservice to those of us that are trying to create healthy bodies and healthy children.
And within that narrative, right, like the access to clean drinking water,
right.
other advancements in sanitation. There seem to be a lot of contributing factors, and yet the vaccine gets the choice, right. gets the silver bullet. Maybe that's because you can't make that much money on accessible drinking water because it's seen as such a fundamental right to people to have access to drinking water.
Michael, you're absolutely correct. Is that there is a body of research that's been done that suggests that the decline in infectious disease conditions declined between 90% and 99% before the introduction of the vaccine for that particular disease condition. There's a body of research that suggests that clean drinking water by itself accounts between 70% and 80% of the reason for the decline. You know, it's been suggested that the reason that we have low disease conditions today is because of the invention of the toilet. I mean, and you can scoff at that, but if what you discover is that there's a body of evidence that suggests that the decline of infectious disease conditions was only declined by 1% by the vaccine program. Now, that information is not publicly available. And when you bring it forward, people scoff at you and saying that you're an anti-vaxxer or conspiracy theorist. And I simply say, don't call me names, read the study, then let's have a thoughtful conversation about what the study says.
And when you're having these thought conversations, I find I have better success if I take that person and I say, okay, well, let's just talk about that for a minute. Then, okay, you come with me to Mozambique, Africa, where I've lived. You come out and you eat with the children who are eating at the local dump. You come out and you poop in a bucket the way that we did. And you don't use hand sanitizer. You don't wipe with modern day toilet paper. You go throw that bucket down into the river, and then somewhere in that same area, you're going to go wash your clothes there. Let's laugh away at public sanitation as, oh, it couldn't be that. But just come with me for 2 weeks and let's see how many different things you can get in 2 weeks by just living an unclean life. This has always been my argument over and against lockdowns, where I look at scripture, and the way to deal with the spread of disease is cleanliness. It's testing and it's cleanliness and all these things. And you look at like any form of lockdown in scripture, like, you know, when a city is under siege and the people just can't get out, like people end up eating their own children in lockdown besiege type environments. Like it's so bad for the human being. And so you just turn around and you look at common experience and go, well, wait a minute. Like we've been washing our hands ever since we were commanded to do it. And that seems to do a lot. And then you look at now the access to clean drinking water and better sanitation and rubbing alcohol, all this type of stuff. It makes perfect sense. And they have to admit it if you say, okay, look, I double dog dare you. Come on a flight with me and let's go live in some places that don't have access to these things and let's see how well your body fares. And none of them will do it. Like, right. They know exactly. I want to get back to you and how you're presenting this. Those thought conversations are often difficult to deal with if we're on the defensive. But if you go on the offensive just a little bit and say, okay, logically, if you think it has nothing to do with it, let's test that theory. They know full well that the theory is testable and provable and that they're living a better life because of all of the cleanliness that we have, all the sanitation.
Well, two thoughts I'll share with you just based on that. So one is, I don't know if you've seen the meme, that which I think is very effective. It's got a fish that's in dirty water. And it says, okay, you know, you could either change the water or you could give the fish a vaccine. You know, what's the solution, right? You know, to me, we're living in a very poisonous environment. And instead of addressing that, we think the solution is to add more poisons by injecting it into our kids. And people might react to that word poison in terms of a vaccine, but when you look at what the ingredients are, and again, that's part of the information that's being withheld from the public, you're injecting things that are known neurotoxins, you're injecting things that are known poisons, and yet you know, I find it astonishing, and I see it with my own kids, is that, you know, they've got small children. I've got grandchildren. They will do 10 hours of research on a baby seat. They will read the label on the baby food before they put it into the grocery cart. There's no research into the same kind of thought into this medical practice. You know, we have been disabled in exercising the same critical thinking we use in other ways around this product. And that's the piece that I think we have to shift.
Okay, so then I'm going to ask the loaded question is, isn't that selfish? Because, again, I've been dealing with this now for probably 10 years since we started asking some questions. And again, people who listen to the podcast, they know that I've lived in this world where I have one cancer survivor and I have a child who has a mild form of spina bifida. Now, you go to the higher levels of medicine, and the very first thing you're told is you have to be an advocate for your child.
Right.
You go to the higher levels of medicine, and it's like, hey, everything we're doing is experimental, and we're working with this all out. And you have to be an advocate for your child. So if they get this drug and it's not working, you have to be an advocate, because medical, doctors get tired. So you get to the higher levels and you're like, question everything. And so you do. You learn on the oncology ward. Okay, what is that drug again? And what's it going to do? And does he really need it? And what's this? Is this another option? And you learn how to all ask all those questions. At the lower level, though, it's just like you said, like, you're not in our country. You can't throw out or you can't pass on child toys and child carriers, like for cars. But you're not allowed to ask questions about literally jabbing your child with a needle the day after they're born.
Right.
So here's where they always get us, or here's where they always get people. It's selfish. If you're the five, you're going to put the 25 in danger. Okay, we literally have a prime minister. Little Justin has the sniffles again, and he's out there. And the very you see his Twitter, and it's like, I have COVID. It's really mild because I've been vaccinated. Go get vaccinated, and it's absurdity. Like the thing that was I was told would protect me. Okay, but he always gets the same old stick. It's because you're protecting those around you. When I look into Vaccine Choice Canada and other organizations like this, I don't see selfish people anywhere. I see people who are accepting a cost for standing up for children. But what is your answer to this selfish question? Because we have to deal with it time and time again.
Well, first of all, you know, the selfish question is it doesn't deal with the science. It doesn't deal with the evidence. It attacks you as a person. And so it's like, let's shoot the messenger as opposed to deal with the issue. And I find that offensive when that's the way these things are dealt with. If the position that I'm taking is flawed in terms of the evidence, in terms of the science, in terms of those things, bring it to me. I'm open to having my mind changed if the evidence suggests something different. You know, but the labels of being selfish is meant to silence. It's meant to marginalize. It's meant to say, don't question, don't think for yourself, do as you're told. And I find that an offensive way to live in a society. I think that if humanity is not allowed to think for themselves, we're in a very dangerous situation. So I think the best thing for society is that we create strong citizens that have the critical thinking, that have a moral base, that are able to make informed decisions, and we empower them to do that. So fundamentally, that strategy I find offensive.
I want to jump in really quick there, just so everybody knows. So, and it's technically a logical fallacy when someone does that to you, by the way. Just so you know, if your doctor ever does it to you, in the world of debate, in the world of civil discourse, in the world of philosophy, it is a logical fallacy to attack. It's called an ad hominem argument, and it is simply a bully tactic. It's a logical fallacy. If you're in philosophy class or if you're on a debate team, you know, the red buzzer goes and you're told, restate your argument. That's not an argument. That's right. That's an attack. That's an assertion. So it's actually in this world that it's supposed to be incredibly critical. It is the most uncritical response. It's a fallacy.
And unfortunately, that's what we've seen for this last 2 years. You know, Michael, when I was first doing my research, when I was beginning to question the vaccine paradigm, I wrote to the chief medical officer in British Columbia, where I am, and I said, you obviously believe in this medical practice. Please provide me with the evidence that affirms and confirms for you that this is the right thing for parents to do. You know what he sent me? He sent me the introductory page of a medical textbook that, and there was a line that he highlighted that says, vaccinations are a miracle of modern medicine. That's all he sent me, a one-page highlighted sentence. And I just wrote back and I said, if this was a grade 6 science test, you would have failed. You know what, you know, but let's get back to vaccinations. What one of the other fallacies is we treat them all as if they're one product, as if they're all the same. Every vaccine is different, operates in a different way, has a different mechanism of working. And what most people don't know is half of the vaccines on the market actually don't stop infection or transmission. What they do is they reduce the level of a response of the body. And so it reduces symptoms. And so people think every vaccine means it's making somebody else safe. It actually doesn't do that. It doesn't change the safety of the community by being vaccinated. People don't know that because they haven't been told that. And so there's so much misrepresentation, so much deception. They make it seem like these are fabulous products. They only do good. They don't do harm. I mean, that oversimplification is dangerous. Every vaccine ought to be considered based upon what's the risk of getting the disease? What's the consequence of getting the disease? What's the effectiveness of the injection? What's the safety of the injection? What's the knowns? What's the unknowns? I mean, that's the level of complexity that needs to be considered for every injection for every child in every situation. That's never done. It might be a very different situation in Africa than it is in Windsor, Canada. And we act as if it's the same situation requiring the same response. It doesn't. And so we're simply trying to be a resource to parents saying, this is the kind of information you need in order to make an informed decision. And it's actually the same information you look for in other medical decisions and other product decisions in terms of your purchasing. Somehow or other, we're shamed and blamed for inviting parents to make the same kind of considerations around this one. And to me, that has so many red flags to it. What it says is, we don't want parents to make their own decision. We want parents to do as they're told. And that's what we've witnessed over the last 2 years. And I don't think that makes a better society. I think it makes a very dangerous situation, as we've seen.
Oh, yeah. All it makes is 1984 come true. That's it certainly doesn't make it a better society. Okay, a few thoughts are whirling around in my head. Number one, I was like, have you ever talked to Dr. Byron Bridal, who is the University of Guelph vaccinologist who really spoke out against all of these mRNA vaccines? I think that would be a fascinating conversation. Have you had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Bridal?
You know, I haven't. I mean, I've certainly listened to many of his interviews. I've read many of the, you know, the evidence that he's put forward, and I admire him greatly. And but no, I haven't. I haven't had that opportunity yet.
I think we should try to figure that out, because I think that would create quite a balanced conversation and good discussion, because I appreciated so much about Dr. Bridal making similar statements of the evaluation of vaccines. And of course, he's more positive about the whole experience than maybe you or I would be. But that would be, so that was just right, jumbling around in my head. So the other thing that we move from here then, if we're looking at different products and different outcomes, is Vaccine Choice Canada partnering with anybody to track all of the vaccine injuries of the last 2 years? I'll just use the story that's in the headlines. Probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we heard, you know, Justin Bieber's canceling performances in Canada because he's got some neurological problem with his face. And then And at the same time, you hear that his wife has had cardiac issues. All of those things are, you know, put out into social media, and then it goes through two filters of information. People like you and me might be sitting there going, "Well, I sure would like some more study to be done." And then the other side is like, "No, this is absolutely unrelated to two people who quickly ran out and got vaccinated just recently." What's Vaccine Choice Canada doing? Is there vaccine injury occurring? Can you share with us the information that you've got on that issue?
So first of all, Michael, there is an unbelievable level of vaccine injury and death that's occurring. If you track using the VAERS system from the United States and look at over a 30-year period, the amount of injury and death reported in a temporal period following injection, what you discover is that there is more injury and death that's happened in the 12-month period or so since the COVID injections rolled out than in all the vaccines combined over a 30-year period. So and there's a graph that shows the level of reported injury and death following injection of all the vaccines on the market. And it's this, you know, thin red line on the bottom of a chart. And then you come to 2021, and there's this huge mammoth spike that goes up. And when you add it all up, there are more reported injuries and deaths, as I said, in the last 12 months than 30 years of all the vaccines combined. You know, there was enough evidence 2 months into the release of this product under an emergency use authorization, which meant that it didn't go through the proper safety protocols of every other vaccine, which is already less than what goes through with any other pharmaceutical product. I mean, people think that vaccines are tested to the same degree of criteria as a pharmaceutical product, and they're just not. And then with the COVID injections, that was short-circuited even more. You know, a typical vaccine or a typical pharmaceutical product is monitored for 7 to 10 years to determine mid and long-term safety before it's released onto the market. This product was released literally with 8 weeks of data. And again, to me, it's one thing to say, listen, we have no idea whether it's safe. We have no idea whether it's efficacious. But, you know, we're going to put it out there so you have a choice. That's one thing. But that's not what happened. What happened is they pushed it out there and said, this is the only way out of this pandemic. There's no other option.
To this day, our prime minister still says this is the only way out, even though you're looking around and there's,
you know,
you've been out of it.
And if you look at historically, you know, when they introduced the swine flu vaccine, you know, when they got to, I think it was 54 deaths, they yanked this thing off the market and said, this is too dangerous a product that, you know, we can no longer make this available. They had enough information by February of, you know, they released the product in December. By the following February, the product, by all other standards, should have been removed from the market, and it wasn't. And so this, what we're seeing here is a complete violation of the protocols, the ethics, the science, all of the things that should have said stop, stop, stop immediately were ignored, intentionally ignored.
Ted, this is a conversation that I've had with a number of individuals. I'm thinking of Karen Kingston. I'm thinking of Byron Bridle. I'm thinking about Dr. Stephen Pellick. This is like it's all for you and me now. This is old hat. Like, I've had these conversations a year ago. If individuals want to just look for themselves on this type of information, is this type of information available? Like, are you at Vaccine Choice Canada putting it through your website so they can access some of this and just kind of redigest it? Because, you know, again, you're telling me stuff that it's like, yeah, this is literally, we've been talking about this for over a year now. There's virtually no policy change in the sense of there doesn't seem to be the excuse at the moment to panic, but we have not seen anyone stepping back from policy saying, yeah, we made a mistake in all of these mandates. where can people go and research? Where can you send them for doing their own research?
Well, Vaccine Choice Canada is a great place to go. I mean, we're continually putting up documents, and you know, part of our challenge is because we've been in this for 40 years. I think somebody said we've got 16,000 documents on our website. So you know, we're having to figure out how do we adjust things so that people can find the most relevant stuff for the issue today. But yes, we're constantly posting position papers, evidence, you know, scientific results. We put out a Choice Insider, we call it. It's our weekly newsletter that is just chock full of the most up-to-date scientific information, you know, the information that's coming out. And things are coming out fast and furious. And so I would suggest that, one, is go to our website, but two, sign up to become a member and receive our weekly newsletter, where you're going to get, every week you'll get educated with what you need to have to help you make sense of what's going on.
Where do we go from here in the sense of, do you, as you're watching, do you feel as the fall comes around, we're going to just face another round of booster? Do you feel like, as you're listening to our government, do you feel that our government is going to change the status from fully vaccinated from 2 to 3 doses? Are you sensing from the people that you're interacting with any type of fatigue within the regime? Or is it just, again, it's a lovely summertime, and in the north we get outside and we breathe fresh air all summer long and they leave us alone? And when the fall comes, which inevitably, what, like, when does the first spike come? Third week of October or first week of November? I can't remember. It's pretty normative. Are you sensing any change at all, or are you anticipating what we have seen we will see again in the fall?
I expect that what we're seeing we'll see again in the fall in spades. You know, to me, there's an agenda here, Michael, and I'm sure that's no surprise. And the agenda is not a medical agenda. It's a control agenda. It involves everything from digital currency to, you know, a social credit score to, you know, 24, 7 days a week monitoring and tracking. I mean, that's the model that's being introduced. And to me, the COVID narrative and the vaccine was just a way to get there. It was a way to instill enough fear that people will accept a violation of their fundamental rights and freedoms, will accept a trashing of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and think that it's okay to do that. Those that are behind that initiative, this is not a medical agenda. It's a much bigger agenda. And we're seeing it play out in terms of food shortages that, you know, all you got to do is pay attention, and you know that we're going to be in trouble in terms of food supply coming this fall. You look at, you know, they're using language like, you know, yes, the federal government came out this week and said that they're suspending the travel mandates. They didn't say they're ending. They didn't acknowledge that it was a violation of constitutional rights and freedoms. They're suspending it, and they were very clear that they fully intend to bring it back again in the event of another variant. Well, you know, they still haven't justified the violations of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and they've been given every opportunity. If you follow the court cases so far in this country, they do everything they can to try to dismiss the case and not have it heard. They have yet to justify their violation of our constitutional rights and freedoms, as is required under Section 1. Demonstrably justify. They've not done that.
Returning back to the beginning, has your court case been heard?
Not yet. No.
Okay, so everybody, what you have to realize, what everybody listening needs to realize, is that I think I read your case file. Correct me. When was it? March 2020. Was it April 2020?
July.
It was July. Right. Because everybody think about it, July, we're now July 2022 right. In minutes.
2 years later.
Maybe by the time Ted and I release this video, we might actually be in the first week of July. So 2 years ago, and I remember Rocco originally saying, look, even just benevolently saying, you know, things take time and the courts are shut down. So, you know, I expect and I hope that we'll be heard by December 2020. Folks, did you got to hear that? We're in July 2022, and one of the first cases that challenged the constitutionality of these mandates has still not been heard. Was it the first, or was it one of the first? I think it was the first.
It was the first. Yeah, yeah.
Again, 199 pages of witness testimony, along with claim statements, all of these things. It were 2 years and it hasn't been heard.
Yeah,
Ted, I want to also just jump on what you've said there about the coercion designed to get people to question themselves. There's three things that I see really quite regularly now in culture. So number one, we got a ton of people still wearing masks all over the country. I'm back in the USA, and you still see people wearing masks down here. Not nearly as much, but I just got a friend who texted me from Ottawa saying, you would not believe how many people in our capital city are still wearing masks. So that's I kind of want to run around to all of them and go, what's going on in your brain? Like, can you just give me a quick, like, on my bad days, I want to say, what's wrong with you? On my good days, I'm like, okay, I remember constitutional freedom. If they want to wear a mask, I guess they can. But and then on my good days, it's like, I really just want to know what's happened. So, like, I've asked waitresses and those types of individuals, and I get the answer, I'm scared to take it off.
Right.
Like, I've actually heard that answer three or four times. I'm going to be around a lot of people today. And you go, well, wait a minute. If you're going to be around a lot of people today, are you going to wear that indefinitely for the rest of your life? And usually at that point they go, well, no. And then you go, okay, well, what's going on? Like, if you're not going to do it indefinitely forever, why haven't you taken it off yet? Well, I'm scared. Okay. We're seeing that. Number two, if you go to a crowd, the level of timidity that people are having with other people, like eye contact, and even just like, oh, I entered your personal space, and like veering to the other side of the aisle, like, it's noticeably different how people are attempting to be socially distant and socially disengaged when they're out and about, because it's been just so, there's been such a, you're right, just petrified about it. And then, of course, the third thing that I've seen so categorically, even within our family, typical individuals that I would think would be critical thinkers, and just they're struggling in this area, is this thing that the prime minister himself said recently. Well, I have COVID, but I have really subtle symptoms because I was vaccinated. Go get vaccinated. And you go, well, wait a minute. Like, did you have COVID unvaccinated to do a comparative analysis?
Right.
Have you talked to anybody who had COVID who was unvaccinated? Like, what strain did you have? Because apparently that makes a difference. I think it makes a difference. Like, man, I had a really good, like, weight loss program, sleep it off for 10 days bout with the Delta variant. I think it was Delta. Could have been the whatever. I had a longer, more prolonged fatigue than many other people. But then other people, they got it and unvaccinated, and they were good to go 2 days later. So you go, well, just have you asked any questions? Like, why do you assume that it's the vaccine that's helped you and not all of these other 30 factors? And so those are the three things that I'm seeing that would suggest that we've had like a fundamental shift in the way that people are looking at the world and analyzing the world and analyzing their own actions in the world.
And then the fourth thing, just to add to your list, is, and we're not allowed to have these kinds of conversations that you and I are having in public.
Right.
But you're right. You know what? And you know, when you talked about the people walking around with masks, what terrifies me the most is, you know, our Liberal and NDP parliamentarians are all wearing masks still. It's like, do you not read any of the science? Do you not understand? It's like wearing a condom with holes in it, right? And expecting it's going to somehow work. It's tragic to me that so many people are so terrified that their unable to take that mask off. It can't be comfortable. It's not healthy. I mean, the evidence is really clear. It's not healthy. It doesn't work. And yet, you know, the answer probably is that when you say, when are you going to take it off? It's when somebody tells them to take it off. They have completely...
But they're beyond that because someone has said you can take it off.
Well, they said you can.
It probably needs to be more assertive, like where someone's actually saying you're not just allowed to take it off, where someone's saying take it off.
Take it off, right. And so, you know, what we're seeing is, unfortunately, people are now so compliant. They've been terrorized in compliance that they're not even making thoughtful, informed decisions. They've abdicated their responsibility and their right to make medical decisions. And wearing a mask is a medical decision. And again, it's done without any amount of research by most, well, people that are doing it. And I would venture to guess that every person that's wearing a mask has been double and triple injected on top of
it. Oh, yeah.
And so I want to say is, you know, when I have those conversations, sometimes I say, you know, have you gotten the injection? Oh, yeah, I've got three of them. Why are you still wearing a mask? And it's like, you know, I learned that logic doesn't work right now. Facts don't work. That people are in a state, they're in a spell, under a spell. And I think that's the part that's most disconcerting to me is that we can't reach even our own family and friends with some simple logic, some simple basic facts, because they can't receive it. They're captured by a narrative that prevents them from thinking for themselves.
I want to end our discussion. I had a very specific thought about just these points of behavior change and what people are going through. And I think it's important to leave people with some ideas on what they can do. So, you know, what do you suggest over at Vaccine Choice Canada for people as they're kind of battling this thought police, this situation? Are there particular steps, you know, research, engage in healthy discourse? What do you suggest for individuals as they're battling this thought police, this behavioral modification?
Well, Michael, it's a good question. And I think most of us that are in this movement thought that if we just brought forward good enough information that would work. And much to our dismay, we've discovered that it doesn't work. And so then the question is, what else? And, you know, I would suggest that, you know, what's lacking today? There's something fundamental that is broken, I would suggest, in humanity today. And I would suggest what it is that we lack moral courage. We lack a fundamental sense of morality. You know, I've been impacted by my conversation with Brian Peckford. And one of the things that Brian Peckford said to me a couple of months ago is he said, Ted, democracy can only exist in a moral society. And I think we've lost our moral foundation. We've lost clarity about what's sacred. Julius Rochelle, I don't know if you follow him, he's a Canadian writer. I think he writes fabulous work. And he wrote this in his recent essay about the loss of the sacred. To me, Julius Rochelle, I could send you the link for Julius's article. I think he thinks he's very articulate, and he thinks in a bigger picture than most of the conversations. And I think we have to go back and say, what's the fundamentals of the society that we want to live in? And I believe that we ought to go back to the charter and recognize that those are the fundamentals. I said to Brian Peckford recently, you know, people are nitpicking at the language in the charter. And I said, I think we need to stop looking at it as a legal document and start to look at it as a moral document. It declares the kind of society we want to live in. And until we have those foundations in place and use that as our measure of the society we want to create, we're going to constantly be in a state of reactivity that has no moral basis to it. So I think we have to restore a sense of morality. The other one is we have to live with courage. And, you know, Robert Kennedy, I'm talking about, you know, this Senator Robert Kennedy back in 1966 said that moral courage is rarer than great intelligence. And I think he's absolutely right. What I've seen is there are people that can see what's going on, but they don't have the courage to stand up and speak to it. I think we need both of those. And so what I've been saying to those that I'm speaking to is saying, stand firm in your declaration of your individual sovereignty, of your right to your medical choices, of your right and responsibility as a parent to make medical decisions. We have to model the kind of citizenship we want to have in this society, in this country.
That's ironically exactly where I've entered the conversation, because as a Christian man, you get your morality from a revelation. People think that we get our morality from reason, but in reality, we reason from revelation. We reason. We have an accepted authority that we start from, and then we reason from there.
Right.
And as a Christian man, of course, I encourage people to, you know, look to Christ for that moral authority, and then being able to reason from the scriptures and from what he's been teaching. And those two points that you just made are so true. Morality, of course, you know, the framers of the Declaration of Independence talked about the Constitution only being able to serve a religious society. Mm-hmm. And of course, when they say religious, they meant a Christian morality based on biblical morality. And then from that point forward, I've seen the same thing. The time and time again where I've seen somebody say, yeah, I know what's going on. I don't like any of this either. And you go, well, what are we going to do about it? And they're like, I don't want to be that mean neighbor who – I don't want to always be combative. I don't want to be that pastor that divides my church. I don't want to be that medical doctor who gets punished for simply – identifying the problem. And so that moral courage point. Mm-hmm. I want to just give a shout out to a book that I'm working through right now. Ted, you might enjoy this, but I want to give a shout out because it's really talked about how the thinkers of the 19th century have brought about this, you know, this radical individualism, this radical emotional individualism that in so many respects attacks dialogue and morality. And he writes it in the context of the sexual revolution, which is a different topic, but it just helps people understand why we're dealing with people who won't live by, you know, creational norms along with logic that comes from that and are forced to the discipline of logical discussion. It's called A Strange New World by Carl R. Truman. And I'm just enjoying it. I want our listeners to know about it. Ben Shapiro has said that Truman's work is one of the most profound pieces of literature in this century. So it just says, A Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution. Mm-hmm. I know it's a different subject, but it goes to this last point of morality and having then moral courage. Because you're actually villainized for calling out in this culture to morality, however abstract you want to go there, it actually villainizes people. And then to say moral courage, that flies right against individual courage to do whatever they want to do. So I just it for listeners, everybody, I hope maybe you download that, listen to it, or pick up that book. It might help you. And it certainly just is a cross reference for the discussion that Ted and I've been having. So Ted, it's been a real joy. I've had the privilege to interview Giselle in the past. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you were going to be as good as she was, and you're awesome. So thank you so much for coming on and having this discussion.
Well, Michael, and I said to you, first of all, thank you for all the good work you're doing. And I think these kinds of conversations are the way that we move through this. It's unfortunately rare today to have the opportunity for these conversations, particularly in mainstream media. And so we rely on independent media like yours to have the conversations that I think will help us to move through this. Because unless we have these conversations, I think we're going to fail in our desire to live in a healthy, free, and democratic society and moral society.
And everybody, these type of conversations aren't that painful. Like that's the other side of this. Like I know that Ted and I generally agree, and Ted, you know, but there's nuances of Ted's life that I don't know, and he doesn't know about me, and there's nuances of the vaccine conversation that we don't know about each other. And like, this is the thing that's most painful, is that these are rich, good conversations that have always led people to learning and growing. So, Ted, it's been a pleasure. Thank you again. Everybody, make sure you're checking out the Vaccine Choice Canada website. Also, again, just to remind you of those particular transcripts that we've released of our key witnesses, including Dr. Byron Bridle. He's one of them. Those are on our website, www.libertycoalitioncanada.com. Of course, please share this video out with all of your friends who are on your Signal feeds and your Telegram feeds and your messaging feeds. Share this out so they can go to our Rumble channel. And would you please also, if you're listening to this audio podcast, give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening to it, and share with 2 people. That would be really helpful for Ted and myself and for this conversation. Thanks everybody for listening, and Godspeed to you as you enjoy your summer holidays and hopefully a little bit of rest.